child is right in saying that I tried to mount report on the relations between Scotland and Ireland in the university, and it was in preparing that course that I hit upon this topic. And I have talked to Sasser about it over a good many years. But it's one thing talking to a class of students, and another thing talking to a group of experts. And I feel very nervous tonight indeed. Hope that I'll be able to learn something from you about it, because I'm not pretending to be an expert on this particular topic or just the last word to say about it. But it seemed to me an interesting theme, and that's why I thought that you might bear with me if I talk to you about it. Between 1619 and 1637, a handful of Irish Franciscan monks were trying to re-establish Catholicism in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. Now, to those men and the men of their day, it must have seemed that the world they knew was falling in pieces around them. Just let me remind you of the circumstances. Here in Ireland, the Tudor conquest had just been brought to a successful conclusion. From the 1530s, persistent and vigorous policy of expansion had been carried on, and with the submission of O'Neill and O'Donnell, the two northern chieftains who had held out longest, it became clear, even before the two earls, as they became, took flight in 1607, even before that, it became clear that the old Gaelic polity was doomed. Their departure opened up the way for yet more radical changes. An elaborate scheme to colonize six of the Ulster counties with settlers from England and Scotland was put on foot, and in the two eastern counties of Antrim and Down, several individual adventurers were colonizing parts of the country on their own initiative. In northeastern Antrim, the MacDonalds, by a judicious change of allegiance, had ingratiated themselves with the government of the Scottish King, James, and had retained the territories that they had been carving out for themselves over a long period. The other important thing to remember that is that with the expansion of English authority in Ireland went the undermining of the Catholic Church. The Church, like Gaelic society, had survived longest in the north with the overthrow of the Irish chieftains. Came the introduction of the Protestant establishment and the suppression of the church in this part also. But here, as in other respects, the MacDonalds were a case apart, for they, unlike the other new landlords that had been recognized, were Catholic. In Scotland too, dramatic changes had occurred within the memory of living men. Scotland had become virtually a colony of France when, in 1560, a group of Scottish noblemen with English assistance carried out a revolution, expelled the French, established Protestantism, and subsequently expelled the Queen, who had been brought up in France, Mary, Queen of Scots, and put her infant son, James VI, on the throne in her place. When James reached maturity, he had two great political aims. One was to assert the authority of the central government in Edinburgh over the whole country. And the other was to ensure that he succeeded Elizabeth of England on the English throne. In the first of those aims, James had a fair measure of success. He, as he put it himself, brought order to the border. He restrained the unruly families in the border country. He asserted the authority of the government in the lowlands and got a measure of recognition from the great noble families. But in the highlands, he had very limited success. A scheme to establish a colony of lowlanders on the island of Lewis, a sort of pre-runner of the plantation of Ulster, failed. Biggest achievement, really, in getting some sort of recognition of the authority of the central government was thanks to the efforts of Andrew Knox, Bishop of the Isles, in the established Protestant Church of Scotland, and later, incidentally, Bishop of Raphoe in Ireland. Knox was sent on an expedition to the islands, gathered together a number of the leading families, and induced them by a process of persuasion and threats to accept the Statutes of Iona in 1609. Just note about the time that the scheme for the plantation of Ulster was being drawn up. These statutes of Iona, Columbkille, are interesting. They assembled chieftains, pledged themselves to obey the king and his laws, to promote the ministry of the Reformed Church, establish inns, control the production of whiskey, suppress vagabonds and bards, limit the chief's retainers, prohibit the carrying of arms, send the sons of gentlemen to be educated in the lowlands, and arrest and try evildoers. And when they were renewed in 1616, a further provision was inserted that no one could inherit land in the islands who was not able to read, write, and speak English. In other words, you see this queer mixture of provisions have this in common, that they were all designed to undermine the Gaelic civilization and polity and the Catholic religion, and to introduce lowland customs. That was an achievement on paper, but in actual practice the authority of the Edinburgh government was still severely limited in the islands. And then finally, remember the continental background. This was the age of the Counter-Reformation. The unity of Christendom had been shattered, and it was clear that the Protestant revolt was not going to be easily suppressed. The Catholic Church had put its house in order at the Council of Trent, and had launched a powerful counter-offensive, of which the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits, was one of the principal instruments. In 1622, just about the time that I'm going to be talking about, the Pope established on a permanent footing a commission of cardinals called the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith. The Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, charged with the task of spreading the faith throughout the world, not only in the areas that had lapsed into heresy, but amongst the newly discovered heathen. And remember, it was just at this time that the rest of the world had been discovered, and the church was aware of the vast new horde of heathen in Africa, in Asia, and in America. And that was to be the field of propaganda also. Such then is the general background to the episode I want to talk about. In itself, it's an episode of no great significance, but it has a place in the long story of Scottish-Irish relations. And it has the distinction, as I see it, of being the last episode in the saga of the interaction of the Gaelic fringe, the Highlands, the Islands, Ireland, especially the north of Ireland. Throughout recorded history, there had been movement and contact and interaction in this Gaelic area. Because, remember, the seaways, treacherous though they were much more offered an easier means of communication and transport than the highways for a very long period in history. This episode of the vision is the last episode in the interaction of the Gaelic fringe, because Gaelic civilization in both areas, in the north of Ireland and in the Highlands and Islands, was on the eve of extinction in the early years of the 17th century. And although contact between Ireland and Scotland was to continue, indeed was to increase from the 17th century onwards, henceforth it was to be contact between a new Ulster and an anglicised Scotland. But now to the story of the mission. In the 50 years after the Scottish Revolution of 1560, the Highlands and Isles were left very much to their own devices in matters of religion. The Catholic Church was no longer able to maintain or replace clergy, and the new church, whose strength lay in the lowlands, only began to establish a foothold in the Gaelic area as a result of the Statutes of Iona that I mentioned a minute ago in 1609. No doubt the old practices and beliefs survived, and the links with the north of Ireland tended to keep them active. It appears, for example, that the islanders, and especially the people of Barra, were making pilgrimages to Kilpatrick about 1593. A report sent by Sir John Campbell of Calder to Lord Somerset in 1615 says that the people of Islay were Catholic. An account of the campaign against the MacDonalds, written in 1614 or 15, probably by Archibald Campbell of Glen Corrydale, asserts that, "Since my coming here, I found out a number of images which I have caused to be burnt. The religion that the country people has here amongst them is Popish, for there is never a minister in the whole, except one poor man that the bishop did leave here." And finally, some years later, in 1629, Cornelius Ward, of whom I'll be saying more in a moment, Cornelius Ward informed the Congregation of Propaganda in Rome that while there were places in the Southern Highlands and the Hebrides which had not seen a priest or minister since 1560, some of the people had memories of Catholicism and had not been affected by the new faith. So there is bits of evidence of a survival of Catholicism, but nothing in the way of a regular church or a regular clergy. We may say then that Catholicism was at a low ebb in Scotland, and that indeed is true of the whole of Scotland, not merely of the Gaelic fringe. In the opening decades of the 17th century, there were never more than 17 or 18 priests in the whole country. Highlands, Lowlands were lost. About 1623, for example, there were only 15 Catholic clergy in the whole of Scotland. 4 Franciscans, one of them an Irishman, 2 Capuchins, 1 Benedictine, 4 Minims, and 4 Jesuits. There's not a singular secular priest in the whole country. The Scottish seminaries on the continent, the colleges established by Scottish priests at Rome, Douay, and Paris, were not producing priests in any numbers at this time, able or willing to work in Scotland. Up to 1620, none had come from Douay or Paris, and only 4 from Rome. So the Scottish colleges on the continent were not doing anything about the state of the church in Scotland. There was, however, at Louvain, a college called St. Anthony's, which had been set up by the King of Spain for the Irish Franciscans to help them in their efforts to preserve the church in Ireland. It was to this college that those who were concerned about Catholicism in Scotland turned in their search for priests. They did so because the priests at St. Anthony's knew both English and Irish, and that was essential for the conduct of a mission in Scotland, especially in the Highlands. Round about 1611, various appeals were made to Rome asking that some Irish Franciscan should be sent to Scotland as missionaries. By direction of the Pope, negotiations were begun between the Papal Nuncio in Belgium and the superiors of St. Anthony's about the possibility of a Scottish mission. The college authorities were not enthusiastic. They argued that they couldn't bear the expense of such a venture, that the college couldn't supply enough priests for Ireland, let alone Scotland, and that their Irish benefactors would not be so generous if they found that part of the money they donated was being used to sustain a mission in Scotland. However, under pressure from Rome, they eventually yielded to assess the situation and discover the problems. John Ogilvie, who had been associated with St. Anthony's before he became a Jesuit, went to Scotland in 1612, and later, the following year, a Scottish lay brother from St. Anthony's, John Stuart, was sent to join him. After a time, Ogilvie sent Stuart back to Louvain to present a report on what they had discovered in Scotland. All this took time, but eventually, in 1618, financial aid was promised from Rome, and Hugh McCockwell, the guardian of St. Anthony's, who later became Archbishop of Armagh, agreed to provide two priests for the Scottish mission from this Irish Franciscan college. Two priests. They were Patrick Brady and Edmund McCann. John Stuart, the lay brother, was to return to Scotland with them. And so, on the 4th of January 1619, they set out for Louvain, and they reached Scotland about the middle of March. Before leaving, they were supplied from Rome with soldiers' clothes for the journey and 60 florins each. In addition, each of the priests had a chalice and everything necessary for saying mass. Father Brady was assigned to the Highlands and Father McCann to the Isles, because he had a better knowledge of Gaelic. Stuart was to assist each of them in turn as a catechist and to act as a means of communication between them. Not long after they arrived, an attempt was made by a group of Protestant ministers to capture them. Not, we are told, to hand them over to the authorities, but to force them to teach them, the Protestant ministers, Gaelic. Because one of the great problems of the Protestant church in Scotland was that they too had not enough Gaelic speaking ministers to conduct a mission in the Highlands. However, the two priests escaped from this group and set to work. McCann's success in even evangelizing the islanders attracted the attention of the authorities, and a reward of 3,000 marks was offered to anyone who would take betray, capture, or kill any of these priests. McCann was so hard pressed that he had to make several journeys to Ireland to escape arrest. Eventually, towards the end of 1620, he was captured and kept in prison for 2 years. Then he was banished and ordered not to re-enter England or Scotland again on pain of death. When McCann's arrest became known, further appeals were made to the Irish Franciscans at Louvain to come to Scotland. 20 volunteered to go, but many of them were considered too young and inexperienced. Eventually, 4 were chosen. Edmund McCann had volunteered to go back again, Paul O'Neill, Patrick Hegarty, and Cornelius Ward. On the 4th of September 1623, they were approved as missionaries by Pope Urban VIII. Each of them was to receive an allowance of 70 scudi from the Congregation of Propaganda. The nuncio at Brussels gave them full instructions before they left. They were to pay special attention to the Isles, where Catholicism was felt to be stronger. They were commended to three lairds: Hector MacLean of Carskate in Kintyre, Col MacDonald of Colonsay, and Roderick MacLeod of Harris, who were known to be Catholics and who would help them. They were to enter in a notebook the names of those they converted or baptized, and from such notes they were to draw up a report on the progress of the mission for the nuncio. Finally, they were to meet at least once every 3 nights to consider means of promoting the faith. There was no mention of a helicopter being provided for them to make this possible. The arrival of this group brought the number of Franciscans working in Scotland to 8. 5 of them were Irish and 3 Scots, of whom John Stuart was one. But Stuart was captured at Drogheda in 1625 while on a visit to Ireland and imprisoned. He was released on orders of James and instructed to return to Belgium, where he died in 1625. So that was the end of him. Of the other missionaries, Paul O'Neill withdrew from the mission after 2 years, and this left 4 Irish friars working in the Highlands and Islands: Brady, Hegarty, McCann, and Ward. These 4 made up the entire mission until they finally were forced to withdraw in 1637. Various other Irish Franciscans were approved from time to time, but there's no evidence to show that they ever went to Scotland. Now, it doesn't follow that the 4 that I've mentioned spent all the time in Scotland from their arrival until their final departure. Of the 4, Patrick Brady spent the longest time. By 1637, he had been working in the Highlands and Isles for 18 years in all. He'd first gone there in 1619, and only on 1 or 2 occasions did he visit Ireland for a short spell in order to avoid arrest. Patrick Hegarty didn't work in Scotland at all after 1631. In that year, he took up residence at Bonamargy and from there directed the activities of the mission. How that arose is this. In a report by Cornelius Ward of the activities of himself and his companions on the mission from 1624 to the beginning of 1625, Ward asked that the Friary of the Franciscan Third Order Regular at Bonamargy be granted to the mission in Scotland. It was, he pointed out, within easy reach of Scotland, and no member of the Third Order Regular had been in the Diocese of Connor or in the diocese bordering on it for many years. Well, this request was granted. On the 2nd of May, 1626, the nuncio at Brussels wrote to the Congregation of Propaganda saying that since there were no members of the order left in Ireland except a few old men who lived in remote districts, there was no obstacle in that grounds. Besides, the Earl of Antrim, on whose lands the friary stood, had no objection to the missionaries taking possession of it. This they seem to have done forthwith, for in 1628 a statement on the activities of the mission reports that Ward had been in Scotland twice during the past year, but that he came back to Bonamargue on the advice of some of the Scottish gentry who had been converted, because it was easier for him to go to the Isles from Bonamargue than from the Scottish mainland. So he stayed there and went to Scotland when he got a chance for a few weeks. Brady was in a district bordering on the Highlands and stayed there permanently. But Hegarty was spending some of his time with Ward and sometimes making quick visits to the Islands. A petition by the missionaries to the Congregation of Propaganda in 1629 asked that the church at Bonamargue be granted a privileged altar. Great crowds were frequenting the place, and usually there were 8 or 9 priests in the community. By this time it's clear that the friary had become an important centre for the work. To return to the mission, Cornelius Ward continued to work for the mission until 1637, but the 13 years from his arrival were not all spent in Scotland. On 2 occasions at least, he visited Belgium and Rome in an effort to stir the Congregation of Propaganda to give more adequate support to the mission. And for 2 years he was in prison after being captured in London in 1630 on his way back to Scotland. About McCann's work after his return in 1624, nothing is known. The main field of the mission's work was in the Scottish Highlands and the Hebrides. Further north, Reformed ministers were more numerous, the people less inclined to Catholicism, and the laws against Catholics more rigidly enforced. So, on the mainland, they worked mainly in Kintyre, western Invernessshire, the Ross of Mull, and Bute. In the Hebrides, the Isles of North and South Uist and Barra were visited, as were the southern isles of Islay, Olonsay, Jura, Colonsay, and Arran. Some of the smaller islands too, like Cana, Rum, Egg, and Muck, figure in the reports that the missionaries sent. Paul O'Neill, although he spent only 2 years in the mission, was 20 months in Skye and the surrounding districts. Ward visited Skye sometime between 29 and the last months of 35. Sutherland in the Northern Highlands was Brady's field of activity. From the beginning, he worked on his own and had very little contact with the others. He appears to have lived with some of the lairds. Now, all these missionaries were from Ulster. The Irish language which they used in their work was evidently understood by the people they worked among. They preached, said Mass, heard confessions, baptized, solemnized marriages, and made conversions. Though the meaning of the term conversion is vague, but they seem to have applied it equally to those won from Calvinism and those brought back to a proper exercise of their Catholicism. In 1633, Cornelius Ward stated that all the missionaries between them had by that time converted 6,627 in the Highlands and Islands, and baptized 3,010. These figures were challenged by some Scottish priests in Rome, because there was no love lost between Irish and Scottish priests. There were various issues of dispute, one of them being the claim that the Scottish priests made to certain Irish saints, that the Irish thought they had no right to claim as theirs. So the Scottish priests at Rome, who had done nothing about Scotland themselves, were constantly stirring up trouble for these missionaries at Rome. And they said these figures were an invention. But the result was that the Congregation of Propaganda decided that they must have definite proof of the veracity of these reports. And in the meantime, they withheld the annual allowance. Testimony in favor of the missionaries and statements about the number of converts they had made were got together from lairds and others that carried some weight, eventually the congregation declared itself satisfied about the truth of their claim. So as we see, it didn't follow that they paid over the money. Indeed, during the 20-odd years of its continuance, the mission was hampered and harassed by constant vexations and difficulties. To begin with, the instructions issued to them when they went to Scotland were utterly unrealistic. How could they possibly meet once every three nights? Again and again, Rome was petitioned for more ample powers or facilities, especially for facilities to dispense in matrimonial cases. But replies were very often slow in coming, and often when the faculties requested were granted, they were restricted in such a way as to make them virtually useless. For example, missionaries sought faculties to bless chapels and cemeteries, vestments and chalices. The faculties were granted, provided the holy water or the holy oils used had been blessed by a bishop. But at the time, there wasn't a single bishop to be found in the whole of Scotland or England. Nor had there been one there for many years, so that propaganda couldn't be excused for having overlooked the fact that there just didn't happen to be one at that time. The biggest problem of all, however, was the irregularity with which propaganda sent the missionaries their annual allowance. They relied almost entirely on it for their maintenance, because they took nothing from the people. That they did by choice, but because they didn't want to place any further burden on the people, who were poor and who in some cases at any rate had to pay tithes to the established Church of Scotland. But also, it appears that their people accepted this as a proper state of affairs. These were men of God, and they had come to minister amongst them, and they should do it free of charge. Nice Scottish touch. But as I say, propaganda insisted that in order to qualify for their allowance, they must report regularly on their work. And it complained that reports were not being sent. Now, it wasn't easy to send reports from the Western Isles in the 17th century. It's probably not very easy to this day to communicate with Rome from the Western Isles. The reports, unquestionably many of them were lost on the way or intercepted. The missionaries certainly claimed that they sent them, and there doesn't seem any reason to doubt, since some reports have survived, that other reports were not sent. This withholding of the money placed great strain and hardship on them, and had a large part to do with the ultimate collapse of the mission. Cornelius Ward was the last of the missionaries to leave Scotland. He came back to Ireland about the beginning of August 1637. Patrick Hegarty, who had already left in 31, you remember, was still at Bonamassa. On the 26th of August, he has written three articles plus a book of documents setting out the reports from these missionaries which he has discovered in the archives in Rome. Now, the reports that these missionaries sent were written in Irish and sent to the Nuncio in Brussels or to the Franciscan House St. Isidore in Rome and translated there into Latin and have survived in Latin in the archives. This is what we are told. But everything points to the fact that Irish was the language that they were using. And it must have been intelligible to the Gaelic-speaking people of the islands. Another of your points about the area where they operated. Yes, it was entirely confined to the Gaelic fringe on the western part of Scotland. There were missionaries and priests in the lowlands. The Jesuits were active in the lowlands, but usually under the protection of some great nobleman living in his house and operating within his sphere of protection, not going out. Well, the Jesuits operated that way. The Jesuits weren't interested in the common people. They believed, and very effective their belief proved to be, that the proper thing was A, to get the king, the ruler, or failing him, the most powerful men in a kingdom. And if you could win them over, that was one thing. The other thing was establish schools and win the young over. But the sort of missionary effort that these Franciscans indulged in didn't interest them at all. So that this mission was confined to the Gaelic part of the country, and although it came to an end, they would appear on the evidence to have recovered ground that had been lost, to give Catholicism a boost, and no doubt to carry it on until the next missionary effort moved in, so that they did have a part in the survival of Catholicism, and as you say, that's where there is a pocket of strength. But of course, you've got to remember that the history of Catholicism in Scotland owes a great deal to the Irish immigration of a later age. with the industrialisation of Scotland and heavy Irish immigration, the present strength of Catholicism in Scotland owes a great deal to that, rather than to the efforts of the Counter-Reformation period. Now, what was the other thing you asked me about, sir? About the monks in the ancient period. Well, no, I...
drawn there because the monks had already gone to Iona.
I don't think that that could be said to have had any direct influence on it, except that the movement of the early Irish monks to Scotland was part of this traffic within that Gaelic fringe that went on for centuries, and that the Franciscans in the 17th century, in the very last days of Gaelic civilization before the final collapse, were following in the footsteps of a constant stream of traffic right down through the centuries. But there was no conscious awareness of this. It was just a natural thing to happen.
You said that Cornelius Ward reported that there was no regular of the Third Order had been in the Diocese of Connor for years. Why was that?
I presume it was because of the effectiveness of the Reformation that the order had been completely dislocated by this time. After all, the survival of Bonamargue, now my good friend Hugh Alexander Boyd there very kindly gave me a lot of information that I didn't know about Bonamargue, and I learned a lot from it, thank you very much. The survival of Bonamargue was something strange, and was simply due to the fact that the far north of Ireland had been so inaccessible to British, to English influence, that the building had actually survived. But the English Protestant Church was established in Ireland in the 1530s, and now we are talking about the 1620s, 90 years later or something like that. So that by that time, as an organized church in any form and with any religious order, it had been driven underground, and the Franciscan Third Order had evidently suffered pretty severely. That's the, I think, the answer.
I think also possibly the professor that was part of County Antrim at that time was very much underpopulated. They really came one time to give a talk here. One of the phrases that she used impressed me very much. Said that when you leave Cargan, she'd come through Ballymena, when you leave Cargan and you arrive in Cushion Dall, there's hardly any signs of civilization at all.
Sure, it's still true.
She thought that she was talking about the 17th century, that in that time the oldest north of Antrim was a deserted region.
Yes. I think this is absolutely true. There are no, there's no means of knowing what the population was even in the 18th century. But at the beginning of the 18th century, the population of the whole country, if I remember rightly, is estimated at 2 million plus. Now, in the 17th century, after a very long period of devastating war, the population must have been very thin indeed. So that you may take it absolutely that the whole country was underpopulated. Ulster had endured 9 years of devastating war, which had been conducted as a war of attrition, with the destruction of crops and cattle, and resulting, no doubt, in death from causes other than war. So that the whole population of the country, and especially of the north, must have been very thin indeed. And this would explain why the friary at Bonamargue was a safe refuge. It was in lands controlled by the MacDonalds, who were very well in with the king, the Scottish king. It was very remote from Dublin. There had been that expedition in Mr. Boyd, 1590-something. Was it 84? When the MacDonalds burnt the the church. That was 84, was it? Not so very long before. And they hadn't held it, you see. They'd been driven out. It had been a hit-and-run operation. So that altogether it was very remote and a pretty safe refuge.
This preservation is probably due, too, in a way, to the fact that the first Earl of Armstrong built a private chapel and a burial vault there, so he had a stake in it from then on.
This is an interesting point, because it can't have been in very good shape after Perrott's men withdrew.
Well, that's why he got the government grant to rebuild it, that stage.
He must have rebuilt, you see. But it was clearly usable, and they were able to move in. It wouldn't have been possible, of course, if it hadn't been a very late foundation. You know, it 1500, it was just 100 years plus old. If it had been a medieval foundation, it wouldn't have been so usable. It was possible for them, evidently, to repair it. But the speed, after, you see, all you've got to go on are these reports. And you have this letter asking for the use of the friary. Then, very shortly afterwards, you have a letter from the friary. So they must have moved in very quickly. So that it must have been in sufficient state of repair for them to occupied without a long period of preparation before. Anyway, having lived in the Highlands, they probably weren't too choosy about accommodation.
That phrase, the beast of the high, was that Scots coming across to the Irish shore?
Yes.
Have you any information on a son of the Earl of Antrim who was supposed to be a Franciscan missionary? Have you heard of that? Reverend Francis MacDonald. Oh,
yeah. There was a Scotchman taken to the continent, but he was
was
taken from Scotland.
He was a minister.
Yes.
And
was converted. But no, I haven't come across any reference to a member of the Antrim family.
This is a son of the Earl of Antrim, was a Franciscan, and you'd have thought it natural that he should have gone back to the homeland, to the Isles, to convert them, but the father was against that for political reasons.
I don't think he ever made the land to Scotland, sure.
Apparently the Earl of Antrim didn't want him sent to Scotland. And made this
See, the funny thing is that the Scottish clergy on the continent showed no eagerness to return to Scotland at all.
I have a theory, Professor McCracken, in connection with the four manuscripts that were found in the Antrim vault in 1821 and 1822, I've been thinking this over, and having regard to their state, whenever Hubert Smith delivered his lecture on the subject way back in 1852, I have a feeling that those manuscripts must have belonged to this Spaniards, because they were, I mean, they don't date from 1500 or anything like that.
I see, yes, they're later, are they?
I beg pardon?
Are they later?
Oh, yes, they're later. Yes. And that is a thought that that has crossed my mind, that those manuscripts could well have been used by the friars, Peggotty and so on, in connection with the Scottish mission, because when they were found in 1821 in the Antrim vault, they were in too good a condition to have been, say, pre-Reformation.
Quite. A very good point.
Yes.
And now, I haven't come on anything that could confirm that absolutely.
No, no,
but,
nor could I.
But in these reports, there are references to the missionaries bringing books, which is strange considering the difficulties, but they did apparently bring, they brought equipment with them, chalices, and they brought wine and wheat for the host. And there's a reference to books. Now, if that is so, you see, they might conceivably have had these manuscripts as well.
But of course, the chalice that's in the Roman Church and the Church of Ireland is pre-Reformation. And
yes.
Has the Calvary and the three crosses, and that wouldn't have been on a chalice
of a host one, of course. Quite.
Would the Bible, sir, have been available in Gaelic in those times?
No.
Personally,
no. Latin, probably.
Latin only. Yeah.
It's rather interesting that Knox, who was Bishop of the Islands and then was transmitted to Rafo, he was never in priest's orders. It's a rather curious fact that he was then.
Is that so?
No.
Really?
He was consecrated per salt. And had never been in priest's orders. He was a minister of the Church of Scotland and then was consecrated to the Irish.
Yes.
But was never a priest.
That
the same happened to one of the bishops of Killala. So
yes.
There's an exercise in ecumenism, or whatever you like to call it.
Very interesting.
I see a reference here in the matter to which Cal referred about the suppression of the distillation of illicit whiskey being one of the reasons for emigration. And it goes on to say, a cutter could distill 2 pints of whiskey per week and could sell this at 5 shillings a pint. This enabled him to keep a servant and an extra cow annually.
I'm getting away from the mission.
It's been a great pleasure to
hear that very interesting lecture on the complex which Professor McCracken mentioned. Now we have the Roman Catholic Church, of course, in Ulm, the cathedral, partially due to the efforts of the Marquess of Bute, a rather beautiful building it is. And as for connections with Ireland, in the Episcopal Cathedral in Ulm, you'll find on the chapter stall such names as Kieran of Clan McNoyes, Malays of Devonish in Fermanagh, pardon me, and Bridget of Kildare. I saw them in September when I was staying in Iona, and I was very interested in that. The Franciscan Order, too, was the strongest agency, I think, in Ireland of all the orders in compounding what we might call the Irish Counter-Reformation. That its significance in the Irish Counter-Reformation was very, very marked indeed. It played a very important part in that. And also, too, the Franciscan Order always liked the Lord. Hence it is that their patron in Bunamargue was the Antrim family. And they buried there. There are, I think, four earls and two countesses of Antrim buried in the vaults. I was speaking on this theme on Wednesday evening last, and I remember visiting the vaults with Margaret, Lady Antrim, and Angela, the present Angela, Countess of Antrim. And I remember saying to their ladyships when we were in the vaults that this must have been the first time in history that the vaults had two Countesses of Antrim present and two Countesses of Antrim in coffins. I don't think that's happened ever before or since. It was a very informative lecture, and my good wife here, I know, has made copious notes, which I certainly will follow because I can't write quickly. She has always been able to do that, and I follow them tonight with great interest. And I would like to conclude, Professor McCracken, if I may, by going from the sublime to the ridiculous and mention an incident that happened here in Cushing Dun many years ago. I think it concerned, funnily enough, a university professor. And I think this is, you're the second professor since then. It was Gordon Child, Professor of Archaeology in the University of Edinburgh. And he and I were motoring up towards Shane's Cairn, just on the other side from here. And the road was very narrow in those days, I think much narrower than it is now. There was a motor car coming from the Tor direction into Cushing Dun, and I said to Professor Child, I think you'd be well advised to stop, to let this man pass, which he did. And the car passed without incident. But hardly had we started until another car came. And I said to Professor Child, I think you'd be well advised to stop again. Oh, he said, it'll be quite all right. So this man came on, and his car very nearly overturned in the ditch, getting past the professor. And he stopped afterwards, and he shouted to us, "Do you need the whole of the road?" So, and he's a real good lens accident. And I can always remember that Professor Child had a terraplane car, a Canadian make of a car. It was very powerful. And I can remember that instant. But I hope Professor McCracken and you're going home tonight and not need the whole of the road. Thank you very much for a very, very intellectual and worthwhile talk on the Franciscan mission to Scotland. We all enjoyed it immensely. It was a great honour to have you here, sir. And thank you very much.